Today's Taisho will be on case 84 in the Piyan Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 84 is entitled Wima's A Gate to the One and Only. Engo's Introduction. There is nothing right that can truly be called right. There is no wrong that can truly be called wrong. With right and wrong eliminated, gains and losses are forgotten. It is all obvious and exposed. Now I want to ask you, what is in front of me and what is behind me? Some monk may come forward and say that in front there are the Buddha hall and the temple gate, and behind the bedroom and the sitting room. Tell me, is that man open-eyed or not? If you can see through him, I will acknowledge that you have seen the ancient worthy one. Main subject. Wima asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all dharmas, there are no worlds, no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Wima, each of us has had his say. Now I ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Secho says, what did Wima say? And again he says, I have seen through him. Secho's verse, you foolish old Yui Makitsu, sorrowful for sentient beings, you lie sick in Biyali, your body all withered up. The teacher of the seven Buddhas comes, the room is cleared of everything. You ask for the gate to the one and only. Are you repulsed by Manju's words? No, not repulsed. The golden-haired lion can find you nowhere. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. As we were walking outside, we could see through the glass the rain coming down. And, you know, I spent much of my life in Seattle, some portion of my life. Actually, I realized with a shock that I have lived more of my life in New Jersey than anywhere else. So I guess I actually love living in New Jersey, but still it was a shock. I still kind of think of myself as a Seattleite, you know. Days like this are very common in Seattle. Practically, maybe I would guess 300 days a year look like this, or look like yesterday. And when the rain falls, you know, actually, if you were planning to go to the shore or you had other outdoor plans, you know, maybe this is a little disappointing. But on the other hand, you know, if you really sort of sit patiently with the rain, you begin to realize just how, you know, remarkable, how wonderful it is. You know, I am a gardener. I like to garden, and about the middle of last summer, we were in a drought. Most people didn't realize it, but the state was very dry. In fact, we went for more than a month without rain, and all the plants, all the trees, all the different plants suffer very much when there's no water. They get very dry and they can die. Many trees in New York City, for example, died last summer because of the drought. So, you know, it's really wonderful when we get a lot of rain in the spring, because spring is when the plants need it most. It's timed for you know, there's a kind of synchrony. So you know, the spring rains coincide with the emergence of the plants from the ground, and the plants come out of the ground very quickly when there's rain, and then you know the plants sprout, and the insects come out of their burrows or out of their cocoons and start feeding on the plants, especially little worms. And the worms start falling out of trees or building their nests, and the birds have their young. And the birds need the worms, the caterpillars, I should say, in order to feed their young. People don't realize, but you know, baby birds of any kind have to have caterpillars or small worms in order to survive. They can't eat seeds. So mother birds are frantically searching for caterpillars and larvae and other kinds of worm-like creatures that have a lot of protein to feed to their babies. And all of this has to happen simultaneously, or big problems arise. So, you know, if there's a drought, the plants don't necessarily come up, or they come up in a very delayed way. And then if they're delayed, the insects are delayed. And if the insects don't appear, baby birds don't survive. So there's this beautiful sort of symphony, and it's all made possible by the rain. It's a living system of interdependence. And when you sit outside and you listen to the rain, or you look through a window and you see the rain falling, you might not necessarily think of any of these things. But I do believe that on a deeper level, you know, the falling rain, the sound of rain, is, for me, it's very comforting. You know, I don't know if you've ever read, you may never have read the Lotus Sutra. I highly recommend it. It's a fairly long sutra, but it's really quite beautiful, and it's quite important to East Asian Buddhism in general, and it's very important to Zen. You know, in the Lotus Sutra, there is a discouraged arhat, you could say. He's discouraged because he's been practicing Zen for so many years, and he hasn't had a great awakening experience. And he has friends who are also monks and nuns, and they've all been practicing the way. They've been sitting faithfully and practicing, and still haven't had Daikensho. And they're kind of depressed, you know, basically. You know, you could say that they go to see the Buddha, and the Buddha says, you know, I've never really told you this before, because I didn't want you to stop trying. But all beings, without exception, all of you, I promise that all of you will wake up, will become a Buddha, just like me. If you, you know, just persist, and if you don't persist, you'll still become a Buddha, because eventually you'll start persisting again. And when these arhats, these monks and nuns, hear this, when these monks and nuns hear that they're going to wake up, they're sort of like enlightenment guaranteed. They become overjoyed, right? Because they had lost confidence in themselves. And they had lost, you could say, confidence in the universe. And the Buddha says, don't worry, it's enlightenment guaranteed. See? Then, you know, the monks and nuns say, how is this possible? How is it possible that enlightenment is guaranteed? you know, we've been so depressed about this. You know, we've been practicing for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and we've been thinking, this will never happen. And the Buddha says, it's enlightenment guaranteed. How is this possible, see? You know, early Buddhists thought along these lines. You know, they thought, you know, the Buddha had an enlightenment experience. He had great awakening experience when he was by himself. And it was such an amazing experience. It was so different from anything he expected or had been taught to expect that he didn't believe anyone would understand it. And in the sutra, in the Pali Sutra, the early sutra, it says that people in India at this time believed that the world was covered with sort of like god-like creatures, you know, like a god of the stream, a god of the forest. And there was a god named Sahampati. And, you know, the Buddha had just had his great awakening experience, and Sahampati, and he's thinking, there's no way I could communicate this to anybody. And Sahampati appears, and he says, wait, wait. You know, he says, a suffering humanity, a whole planet full of suffering people are waiting for you to help them. Don't get discouraged. You know, don't give up the ship. They're waiting, you know, they will hear you. There are many people who will hear you and practice and wake up. So the Buddha says, okay, I'll do it. He taught in many different ways to many different people. You know, it's said that when the Buddha met somebody, he would sort of size up, he was very good at sort of sizing up their needs and expectations. So when he would speak to them, he would tailor what he said to their ability to understand. You know, so in some cases he would make the Dharma very, very simple, so people could understand. And he might say, you know, just live a good life. You know, don't kill anybody. You know, don't try to be helpful to all. Try to be kind to all. And there were people who probably weren't ready to do meditation. And he said, just, you know, in one case he told, there was a woman, he said, when you're doing your chores, just try to be aware of your hands all day long. And actually, if you practice this way, you'll go into deep samadhi, believe it or not. You know, so if you're walking around the house and you just remain mindful of your hands all day long, you'll notice that as the day goes on, you enter into a deep state of concentration. You'll feel very serene, very centered, very present. You enter deep samadhi. And so, the Buddha gave her that advice because he didn't think she could do the kind of sustained sitting we're doing. He gave many different people different kinds of advice based upon their ability to understand. So in some cases, he encountered very, very advanced practitioners like Mahakashyapa or Shariputra. You know, these people had been, you know, Mahakashyapa and his wife had been practicing, for many, many, many years, and they were they had not had broken through to Daikensha, but when they met the Buddha, you know, he just said a few things to them, and all the barriers in their minds collapsed, and they had a great awakening. So basically, different followers of the Buddha were at different levels. And in some cases, it was enough for him just to say a few words, and the illusion would crack open. And in some cases, he had to give very detailed but simple instructions, you know. But after the Buddha died, you know, there were people who had Daikensho also, like Mahakashyapa, or Shariputra, other arhats had had great awakening, but you know they understood the great awakening experience in terms of their own time and the assumptions of their own time. You know, so today in America, you know, we tend to understand Buddhism in terms of our own culture. So, you know, when we think about meditation, we want meditation to be practical and helpful to us in our jobs, right? Because that's very important to us as a culture. You know, everybody in our culture has a career, right? You're working towards some kind of recognition, and you have to be highly competent, where most of us are have a career, some kind of a career, not just a job, you know, but a career. You know, we're doing a kind of work that is how we define ourselves. You know, so when we Americans at the beginning of the 21st century receive the Dharma, we understand it in our own terms as a tool we can use to help us do our jobs better. And that's great. I'm not criticizing that. But that's how our culture has understood the Dharma. In Indian culture, at the time of the Buddha, people understood the Dharma very differently. You know, they thought of life as painful and brutal and short. And, you know, they thought of life as a relatively long stretch of discomfort and suffering and confusion. Yeah. And so, you know, when they thought about liberation, about the Buddha's teaching, they understood it as deliverance from existence, which they thought of as painful and unpleasant. You know, so if you think about it, their way of seeing the world makes a lot of sense, actually. You know, in the Buddhist time, most people probably died, you know, most people probably died in infancy, believe it or not. There were very high rates of child mortality. And even people who didn't die as children and made it to adulthood, you know, maybe like 45 was the end of the average lifespan. So it's very short. You know, many people didn't live to see their children get to adulthood. And it's also the case that, you know, today, you know, if we have a famine, if we have a drought in New Jersey, you know, in the Midwest, they didn't have a drought. You know, so we didn't go to the store and there were no carrots or no lettuce in the store. You know, there's plenty of lettuce, we could have a major drought here in New Jersey, and when you go to the ShopRite, it would be the same set of vegetables on the shelf, you know. But in India, it wasn't like that. You know, if you had a drought, you starved. You know, your kids starved. I don't know if you've ever had a toothache, then you've been unable to go to the dentist, but or a rotten tooth, you know, actually a rotten tooth. Long ago, at a sesshin, my first teacher, Genki Roshi, actually had to leave the sesshin. And he said, "I'm leaving the sesshin because I've got a toothache and it's killing me." And we were shocked because, you know, he could sit with pain in his legs for hours. You know, we would all have pain in our legs and he'd be sitting there very serenely and he'd say, "Don't worry, pain is not real." And he said, "I'm going to have to leave the sesshin this afternoon. I'll be back this evening, but I've got to go to the dentist. I have a toothache." And somebody said, "You know, well, what? You know, aren't you always telling us not to be, you know, not to be overwhelmed by pain?" He said, "But this is real pain." You know. So then he went to the dentist, and he came back and finished the sesshin. We were still there because he was a very great Zen teacher, all the same. But you know, people. Now, before the last year's sesshin at this time, I broke a tooth. And I went to the dentist, and I got the tooth fixed, and then I went to sesshin. You know, but in those days, no dentist, right? You know, so if your tooth was rotting, you just had pain every day, right? if you got some kind of a disease, you know, there's no antibiotics, you know, you just had the disease until it killed you. So, you know, people in the Buddhist time had kind of a pessimistic view of life. And when they thought of liberation, they thought of liberation as getting out of this mess, an end to suffering, end to pain. And the Buddha did teach that his path, he said, you know, the first noble truth is that life is suffering. But he also said, you know, my path is a way out of suffering. Now, people in his time understood that as meaning out of existence, out of existence. So lots of early followers of the Buddha understood nirvana as like extinction, the extinction of existence. It's like completely leaving this world behind. See? But, you know, we Zen people think that was probably made sense to people at that time, but we have a different view. Right? We have a different view. You know, if you could get out of this world, you know, in fact, you know, Buddhists later in the history of Buddhism, you know, Buddhists began to believe that there were other worlds, you know. In fact, you know, Buddhists speculated that there were heaven and hells, just like a little bit like the Western heaven and hell. And there were multiple layers of heaven and there were multiple layers of hell. And they speculated that, you know, people who die, if you're really, really, really good, you can become a god in the highest heaven, which is called Sukhavati. Sukhavati. This is the heaven of bliss. And the gods live there, and the gods don't have any suffering at all. You know, if you're a god in Sukhavati, you just think of a delicious meal, and there it is. See, and you can eat it, and you won't put on any weight. It's great. And you won't ever feel full. You know, you won't ever have indigestion, right? Because you ate too much. You know, so you can eat and it's great. And there's also hell realms full of demons and so on and so on. So, you know, later Buddhists thought of the world a little differently from the early Buddhists. Instead of thinking that it's just this existence and then you can escape or you're back in this existence, you know, they came up with this idea that, you know, there's actually, when you die, you go to one of the heavens or you go to one of the hells. And if you go to one of the hells, it's not like Christian hell. It's not where you go forever. You just go to one of the hells until you've burned off your bad karma. You've paid your, like, debt, your karmic debt. Then you can come back here and try again. And if you are good, instead of going back to the hell realm when you die, you start to go like, you can go up to the realm of the gods, see. But you know, the interesting thing about the Buddhist cosmology is that even the gods, just as bad karma wears out, good karma wears out. So, you know, you can be a god, but then, you know, your karma, it's like your account at the bank is, your account is getting lower and lower as you spend all your good karma. And when it finally goes to zero, it's like down you go back to earth, see? You have to start accumulating karma again. So, you know, there was a change in the way Buddhists thought about the world and thought about enlightenment. Because, after Buddhists began to think along these lines, there were definitely very advanced meditation practitioners who said, you know, this is also a kind of fantasy, just like the fantasy of extinction. You know, all of these different and hell realms and heaven realms are really states of mind that you experience on the cushion. You know, this was sort of, you could say, a teaching of Buddhism in its middle period that, you know, actually, and it's true, you know, when we sit down on the cushion, you know, sometimes we experience a real heavenly bliss. You know, when you sit on the cushion, sometimes you experience bliss. It's just like being in heaven. And, you know, hopefully you don't have too many sits like this, but sometimes you may have some sits that are like being in hell, too, you know. You know, your legs hurt, you're grouchy, you wish you were somewhere else, or maybe something's really bothering you and it's causing you a lot of emotional distress. You know, but, you know, as this belief became popular, you know, there were lots of Buddhists who said, come on, you know, all of these things exist only in your own mind. See? And you know, the Zen, you could say, comes out of the movement that said that, right? You know, really, everything is, if you think of your mind as, you think of your mind as your mind, you might think the way about your practice that early Buddhists thought about their practice. You know, I have to get out of suffering and liberate myself from suffering. And the world is causing me suffering. So, you know, one way to think about meditation practice is as a kind of escape, right? Kind of escape. So when we meditate, we're trying to get out of suffering and get to a place where there's no suffering. And we have to do this by getting rid, you could say, of our paying off our negative karma. You know, that's the way early Buddhists thought about it. And, you know, and another way to practice, and many people still practice this way, is to practice sort of like to get to a better place in this life. You know, in East Asia, for example, lots of Buddhists will go to a temple and say, go to a temple for a day and do a day of meditation to improve their karma. This is quite common. When we used to train at the Seattle Zen Center, there were always a few Japanese people who would come and they'd spend a few days at Sesshin, usually in a lot of pain. And they would be very happy at the end because they would feel like now they would be, they had good karma and they could carry out, get the medical degree or whatever. And they're very happy about that. You know. But, you know, there's another way to think about Zen practice, which is not about like personal liberation and not about improving your life situation, even though I understand that both of these have a kind of truth. You know, so if you're in abject suffering, if you're in abject misery, when you practice, you know, it really is wonderful to get to a place where all your suffering disappears and you have a kind of release from pain. That's wonderful. That's so, such an early Buddhist way of thinking about practice. And, you know, modern Americans, we're a little bit like people in East Asia. You know, when we do, say, mindfulness meditation, we're trying to improve our situation in this life, right? Where, you know, people practice mindfulness to be better on their job. You know, so if you have a stressful job, you know, you can do some mindfulness and it'll help you to focus. It'll give you extra hours to work on your job. So, you know, modern Americans are a little bit like people in East Asia who go to Sesshin to improve their karmic situation. It's like getting a little extra karma, good karma in the bank, you know. And those make sense. People who do that are living in a world that makes sense to them. And they're practicing, and they're practicing wholeheartedly. So I'm not criticizing them. But, you know, when you begin to do meditation, you know, eventually what happens to you is you begin, if you do it long enough, is you realize that those motivations sort of disappear. You know, for one thing, you stop being in so much pain psychologically. You know, if you do meditation regularly, you will probably be a much happier person. And if you also do meditation regularly, you probably will be much better at your job. You know, so I definitely can say that meditation has helped me to be more effective in my job. You know, sometimes I come home at night and I'm really wiped out, and I still have work to do, and I'll have a little like a snack, and then I'll do some meditation, and then I'm ready to work for another hour or two. You know. So it is a big help in the job. But you know, when you begin to do meditation, at some point you begin to experience the disappearance of your personal self. You know, so you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath. And when you become fully absorbed in your breath, or even if you're just watching your thoughts go by, you know, you might suddenly realize, or maybe you won't consciously realize it, but in that state, your self-referencing attention, you know, the I actually disappears. You know, when you're focused fully on the breath, or you're just watching thoughts and trying to come back to the breath, it's like you don't have time to think about yourself. And sooner or later, you enter like an altered state of consciousness, which we call samadhi, in which the self-referencing habit sort of slows down or disappears. And when you are in this state, you feel better. You might not know why, but you know, there are some clues. So, you know, if you're sitting at home and you're sitting for, you know, like a couple half-hour sits, and you're practicing in this way, you're watching your breath, or you're trying to get past your thoughts, you know, you might stop sitting and you might feel that your practice hasn't been that good. You know, you weren't able to get past your thoughts. You kept coming back to the breath, but the thoughts kept coming. Or maybe you were able to enter a deep place where you're focused with one-pointed attention on your breath. You end your sitting practice, and you stand up, and you hear the sound of, like, birds outside. And sometimes it might occur to you that those sounds are so crisp and clear. You know, they're so clear, so crisp and alive. In fact, you know, this can happen to you. You might be meditating and suddenly you hear the sound of a bird and it feels like there's no space between you and the sound of the bird. You know, I think this kind of experience where the boundary between yourself and the world disappears is very, very important. You know, because that's actually true. That's actually real. You know, our sense that we're separate from the things around us gradually diminishes the more we practice. See? And gradually, you know, on the cushion and then off the cushion, there's a kind of, we feel a kind of connectedness to the things around us, even if we're not conscious of it. You know, we feel a kind of calmness or well-being. You know, a good friend of mine, a Dharma sister of mine, once said something like this, that she was walking down the street. She's somebody who does a lot of meditation. She said she saw the face of somebody coming in the other direction, and for a minute it felt like she was looking at her own face. You know, if you practice meditation, you know, eventually you'll get up and you'll drive home and you'll realize you're in your car and you're in kind of samadhi state. You know, my own teacher, my second teacher, Webb, said, you know, when he had been practicing meditation for about 8 years, he got on the bus, he was in Japan, and he realized that he was in deep samadhi riding on the bus, you know. It was kind of a shock. But, you know, this experience of the boundary between ourselves and the world disappearing is really an important experience. You know, because, you know, the way Zen thinks about things is that everything is like one life. One life. And our understanding of suffering is a little different from the early Buddhist understanding of suffering. You know, for the early Buddhists, you know, they thought that suffering was caused by being in this goddamn world. You know? And we all have days where we think like early Buddhists, you know? So you want to ride your bike with your friends, and you pull the bike out of the garage, and you're all set to go, and you realize you got a flat tire, and you can't find your bicycle pump. And it's like, God damn this world, you know. Or you know, you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, you know, that's not just a little bump on your neck. You know, I think you have a cancer. You know, and you know, so there are days where we still think like early Buddhists, like this world is a painful, difficult place, and let me out of here. Right? Enlightenment is release from existence. You know, but later Buddhists, you know, paid a lot of attention to this experience of the boundary between yourself and the world disappearing. You know, when we feel connected to the world, we feel the suffering ceases, and we begin to feel that we're part of one big life, one big life. See, and so later Buddhists, like Zen people, think suffering isn't caused by being in the world; it's caused by feeling separate from the world. See, so you know, early Buddhists wanted out, but later Buddhists said the problem isn't that we're in and we can't get out. The problem is we're out and we can't get in. You know, so Zen. The whole, what's called the Mahayana, the Great Way, later Buddhism said, you know, early Buddhists misunderstood the problem. The problem is that we're disconnected. That's the source of our suffering. And the solution, liberation, comes from becoming one with this moment, becoming one with what's happening. So, you know, our strategy, you know, one way to practice is to seek liberation from existence. One way to practice is definitely to seek to improve your life chances. As so many modern people do, trying to improve their life chances. But and I'm not criticizing. That's good. It does improve your life chances. But there's an even deeper way to practice, which is this practice of becoming one with, you see. So, you know, all the Mahayana, including, and you could say all the Tibetan schools, also come out of that same, and Zen, you know, we understand our problem as working through the barriers that separate us from what is. You know, so in our tradition, we do what are called koans. You know, people know they have barriers sometimes. Sometimes we don't. We're just rather fearful and detached. And sometimes we realize we do have barriers, but we don't know how to break them down. So for example, you know, there are definitely cases. Where, here's an example. I'm trying to think of an example. But you know, my grandfather, my mother's father. I think he was frustrated in a lot of ways, and he was never able to express his emotions. You know, he was never able to express his emotions. And when my mother would talk about him, she said, I realized, you know, towards the end of his life that he loved me. But I never realized that until, you know, just before he died. And I think he was really boxed in. It was very hard for him to get out of his barriers and express his love for his family, you know. And I think we all have barriers like that. We, you know, he didn't really probably even realize those barriers existed until at the end of his life he realized, you know, I'm losing all these people I love, and I've never told them that I love them, you know. So I think, you know, approaching death, you know, sort of like made him recognize some of his barriers, you know. But we all have these barriers, but usually we're not aware of them. We just feel trapped. There's just a vague feeling of being unsatisfied with our lives. And we all have these barriers, see. So, you know, one of our techniques in Zen is a koan practice. And koan practice helps you to work through your barriers by actually putting you face to face with a contradiction or trapping you. It's like saying you have to answer this question, and they give you a question that you can't answer. And you try to figure it out intellectually, but gradually you draw on your, you could say, your emotional intelligence. You draw on deeper parts of yourself. But even your emotional intelligence can't answer it until you dissolve the boundary between yourself and the world. And when that boundary disappears, your emotional intelligence is able to be activated. And you can resolve the koan, see. Main subject. Wee Ma asked Manjushri. Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. What is the Buddha's gate to the one and only? See, what is the Buddha's gate to the one and only? Early Buddhists would have said, you know, the gate to the one and only is extinction of desire, thought, feeling, etc. It is completely extinguishing all these things. But the Mahayana view is different, right? It's completely embracing all these things. Manjushri says, to my mind, in all the dharmas, there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. This is entering the gate to the one and only. When we are in deep samadhi, you know, and we begin to feel connected to the world, this is the path to liberation. This is the gate to the one and only. And we know we are on the road to enlightenment because we feel that when we feel connected, when that sense of separation dissolves and we feel connected. And this is the rhythm of Zen practice. You know, at first you're told to watch the breath, and you watch the breath, and you watch the breath, and you think, what the hell is this all about, you know? But eventually, you know, you become, even if you aren't consciously aware, you become one with your breath. And when you become one with your breath, your self-awareness dissolves, and your mind becomes empty. If you are in deep samadhi and you hear a bird outside, you please experiment, please try this for yourself. And especially, it's especially good if it's a repetitive sound. So if there's a bird outside going tweet, 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 if you're in samadhi and you listen to that, you'll notice your mind becomes absolutely blank. At the same time, you become one with the sound of the bird. This is a fusion of yourself and the world, a dissolving of yourself in this larger world. This is a path to, this Buddha's path to enlightenment. And this goes on and on. You know, in Zen training, we go through barrier after barrier. We open, dissolve the barrier and enter the world more fully and more deeply. And that, at some point, produces a decisive shift in our consciousness, which is what we call Daikensho. Before Daikensho, you're a self looking at the world. And after Daikensho, you're the world living as a self. So, you know, none of this would be possible if we weren't really fundamentally part of the world. You know, in the fundamentally part of the world. You know, the world how should I put it? The path to awakening is non-discriminating mind. Everything, you become one with whatever is arising. This is like the secret. You know, in the Lotus Sutra, You know, the Lotus Sutra talks about rain a lot, as a matter of fact. And in the Lotus Sutra, you know, your fundamental awareness is like a water. Mind is fundamentally like water. The Lotus Sutra says, you know, actually, you have to become like water yourself. Water accepts whatever it encounters, right? You know, the Lotus Sutra says, the rain falls on everything equally, right? It falls on, when the rain falls, it falls on everything in exactly the same way. It falls on, and it cleans everything. It brings everything to life, you know. Just the power of the non-discriminating mind. You know, so, you know, rain falls on the macadam, on the parking lot, and it washes it clean. And it falls on the plants in your garden, and it brings them to life and makes the worms for the baby birds and so on. And it makes no discrimination. And we have to be like that. You have to make your mind like water. You have to be like that rain. I'll wrap it up, but, you know, my second teacher, Webb Roshi, trained at a temple called Daitokuji. At a temple called Ryotakuji in Japan, Ryotakuji. And in the morning, all the monks would get up and they had to wash their faces in using a bucket of cold water. So you'd break the ice on top of the water. You'd pour it into your basin and you'd wash your face. And on the, you know, so it's difficult to wash your face with freezing cold water in the winter. But on the basin, there were four characters, right? And basically it is, I only wholeness know. I only wholeness know. See? So that's the path, that's the Buddha's, how does it, Koan put it? That's the gate to the one and only. I only wholeness know. Becoming one with. Secho's verse, you foolish old Wimakitsu, sorrowful for sentient beings, you lie sick in Bialy, your body all withered up. That is that is Wima, or Vimalakirti, Bodhisattva Vimalakirti. Okay. The teacher of the seven Buddhas comes, the room is cleared of everything. You ask for the gate to the one and only. You ask for the gate to the one and only is becoming one with.